The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
Well, now, it's the sport of kings, but how can the billion-euro industry of horse racing survive the impact of the coronavirus? Alan Byrne is editor-in-chief of the Racing Post, and he's on the line now. Alan, good morning.
Morning, Pat.
It's a bit of a wasteland, isn't it, horse racing across the two islands?
Well, it is, really. We've had no racing since Clonmel last Tuesday. Just in common with the rest of society, everything is in lockdown. The complication, obviously, in racing stables is that they are looking after animals who need to be fed and exercised every day. So the activity continues behind the scenes, but there's no immediate prospect of the horses being able to race on any of the race courses in Ireland or Britain until the terrible virus starts to abate a bit.
Now, we saw, of course, that the highlight of the jump season in Cheltenham, that went ahead, even though it was quite controversial that it did go ahead. We're going to lose the Irish Grand National, the Grand National, so it's really over.
For the jumping season, it probably is. As you say, we're going to lose the two Grand Nationals. We're going to probably lose Punchestown unless things improve a lot. And the flat season had just started. We'd literally just had the opening of the flat season in Ireland at Naas last Monday before the shutters came down. So you know, it is a big problem for everyone, and especially when you think that actually racing is one of the few industries or sectors or sport, whatever you call it, that Ireland is a world leader in. You know, in terms of bloodstock breeding, Ireland produces the third highest number of foals anywhere in the world. About 10,000 foals are born at home every year. And we have probably the greatest racehorse trainer in the world in Aidan O'Brien. And, you know, our Irish horses and jockeys and trainers have made headlines around the world. And, you know, everything, like for so many other people, everything is stopped.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting that UK racing might begin behind closed doors on May the 1st. That's the possibility there would be some flat racing. No possibility of any jump racing because of the need for ambulances and all the rest of it. And they don't want to be taking up hospital beds with injured jockeys and so on. Do you think it's realistic that any racing might start even behind closed doors on May 1st?
I think it probably isn't, to be honest, Pat. I think with the way the number of affected people and the number of deaths in Britain are going, it's hard to see how that could happen on May the 1st. I think it's likely, in my view, that we may have racing back in Ireland behind closed doors with making sure there are no health implications for anybody. That may happen before there is racing in Britain. I mean, we're all having to become amateur scientists these days, and I am certainly not in any way qualified, but it seems to me that the situation has arguably been better managed in Ireland, and there may be a prospect at some stage of things returning a bit sooner, but who knows?
Now, the worry, of course, is that some stables simply won't be able to survive, and not alone that, some race courses might not survive. That was a worry articulated by Horse Racing Ireland Chief Executive Brian Kavanagh.
Yes, and I think with stables, I mean, something to bear in mind, obviously we are very successful, some of the best trainers in the world, but outside those top trainers, very few racehorse trainers are probably making much of a profit. And for any profit they make, they really depend on the percentage of prize money they earn, and they may also depend on earning some commission from sales of horses. So all that income flow has just dried up. They're also going to have owners who have, you know, lost their jobs or seen their businesses damaged. So trainers, like other small businesses, are going to struggle to collect money, and they're going to see their revenues disappear for the lack of activity. So, you know, it is going to be hard on a lot of trainers, and I imagine that many of them, as with other businesses, will be availing of the job preservation scheme to try and see what they can do. But, you know, obviously they still need staff to feed and look after horses.
Yeah, and of course, I suppose self-isolation in a stable environment might be a bit easier, and social distancing and all the rest. As you say, the animals have to be fed, and for racehorses, they've got to be exercised or they will lose their form and you're starting from square one when racing begins again.
Absolutely. And then I suppose it's the same complication as there is with other athletes who are trying to maintain a level of fitness or training. And there comes a point if the return of racing stretches into the distance, there comes a point where, you know, trainers and owners who are paying for it start to ask, well, is there much point in keeping this horse at peak fitness in the hope that something might come back? And then, as you said, you know, what happens? What's the landscape like when racing does return? It's unlikely to be a flick of a switch and everything returns to normal. It's likely to be a staggered return. And it does remain to be seen whether all race courses come through the shutdown. You know, those race courses are very, very reliant on media rights income. Every Irish race course earns €50,000 per fixture or thereabouts from television rights for racing channel viewers at home and for pictures in the betting shops. So that revenue has obviously disappeared. The big tracks are losing the revenue that they would have received from those big attendances on days like Irish Grand National Day.
Yeah, and those races are gone, you know, for this year. It's not a question of, like, Wimbledon maybe trying to reschedule or, you know, finish the Premier League behind closed doors. These races, once they're gone, that's it for a year.
I think there'll be a debate. I imagine that there will be people saying, depending on when the return comes, if the return is many months away, then they may indeed be gone. But I think if, say, we were to return in 6 weeks' time with some sort of racing, I think there would be a debate as to, well, which races can be salvaged. The question would arise as to how do you fund them? If you're running a Grand National behind closed doors and you're deprived of the revenue from the attendance and the corporate hospitality and the bar and the restaurant, it's harder to put up good prize money. And I imagine with the flat racing, the longer the shutdown goes on, there'll be a big argument as to, do you try to truncate the key features of the season into a reduced time? Or do you say, if we've missed the Derby, it's too bad, there's no Derby this year? In America, what they've done is, although they're still racing on some racetracks in America, or have been up to now, they have decided already that the Kentucky Derby, which is normally the first Saturday in May, that will be run in September. So I think there will be, you know, a lot of debate as to, well, do you try to preserve the core races? But as you say, if the shutdown is prolonged, it's hard to see those key jumps races being staged.
Do you think there'll be bloodstock sales online so that, you know, people, I suppose, if you'll pardon the racing phrase, take a punt on buying something based on digital imagery?
I think that it may be tried. I think, you know, this virus will change a lot of habits in all across the economy. In Australia, their premier horse sale is always the Easter sales. And what they're going to do this year is they're going to stage it online and the animals will stay on their farms. Now, the problem with that is that, you know, the basis on which people choose which horses to buy is very much on physique and movement and seeing the animal close up. So I imagine that the sales companies in Ireland and Britain, Goffs and Tattersalls, will be looking closely to see just how much of a struggle is the sale in Australia and is it practical? And there are some sales that would normally be taking place from now on, what they call breeze-up sales, which are two-year-olds that are ready to run, and there'll be a lot of people who have invested a lot of money to have horses to offer for sale in those sales, and they have not got anywhere to sell them at the moment. So there'll be quite a few people hurting across the wider bloodstock and racing economy whose expectations, as with everybody else's expectations of what life would be like, have been completely upended by the coronavirus.
All right, well, we shall see where all of this goes. But a financial crisis, obviously, for many people in the equine industries. One last point, Alan, and it's, you know, a text from a listener here that horse racing shot itself in the hoof by continuing with Cheltenham when a lot of wise heads were saying, no, it should have been cancelled. That's from Dara in Finglas. What do you say to those people who feel very negatively towards horse racing now because of Cheltenham and the punters going off to Cheltenham and coming back, and some of them bringing back the coronavirus with them?
Well, I think it's obviously easy to be wise after the event. I mean, I was in Dublin on the Saturday before Cheltenham. The chief medical officer was saying there was a low probability of contracting coronavirus. On the Monday, as the punters set off from Ireland for Cheltenham, the St. Patrick's Day parades were still on. They weren't cancelled till that evening. It wasn't till the second day of Cheltenham that, sadly, the first Irish death from coronavirus took place. It wasn't till the Thursday that Leo Varadkar made his address in Washington and closed some things down. And still, after Cheltenham, the pubs were still packed that weekend and had to be closed down on the Sunday night. So I think there's a bit of after timing going on. You know, if we knew then what we know now, it might have been different. And equally, I'm sure that games in the Champions League, like Valencia of Spain versus Atalanta of Italy, would not have taken place at the end of February. And, the second leg of that, I think, took place during Cheltenham. So, you know, a lot has changed. I think when the Irish racegoers set off for Cheltenham, the world was very different to when they returned. And I think it needs to be seen in that light.
Alan Byrne, editor-in-chief of The Racing Post, thank you very much for joining us. Now, some of the comments coming in. It's time for people to stop shopping for non-essential items online. I work as a courier for one of the largest delivery companies. Although we are considered an essential service, about 80% of what we're delivering is throwaway fashion and other rubbish to private houses. Interesting comment, that one. Michael Harding is very therapeutic. This time is giving us an opportunity to get to know ourselves and our own resilience. That's from Rose in Longford. Following on from Michael Harding, there is a saying, if you fail to go within you, go without. Michael is a lot wiser than he gives himself credit for. Stay healthy. Why are the Gardaí not observing social distancing, sitting next to each other in cars all the time? On cycling, I did a 15K cycle today without doing more than 2K from home. It's not hard to figure out a route. That's from Dermo in Dublin 15. Just to clarify, it's a radius of 2 kilometres. I've done numerous laps, but stayed within that distance, hence wearing Lycra on the bike. Another one, the circumference of a 2K radius is 12.57 kilometres, so I try to go round in a loop as much as possible within an hour. These cyclists exceeding that are jeopardising the exercise for the rest of us cyclists. They are selfish. And this one, the horse racing industry is based on a very lucrative gambling market. A higher government tax on gambling could pay towards the national corona bill, says one. Well, now this is where we take a break from all the bad news and bring you something to make you laugh out loud. And we have chosen a clip today. It's a wonderful story of Cork one-upmanship from the late, great and recently passed Neil Tobin.
But anyway, as I said, this recession has hit everywhere, and it hits the Dublin Corporation. At the end of the fiscal year, they found that they had really no money at all left to carry out any kind of a building programme, you see. But they felt that they should perhaps, you know, just to save face, advertise for something. They managed to scrape up £3,000. And they advertised for the smallest possible public building they could think of, which was, needless to say, a public convenience. And they only got three replies. They got one from a Dublin builder. He was the first man in, and they said, what's your bid? And he said, well, I tell you the truth, I wasn't going to bother. I wasn't going to bother me arse, no, I'll tell you that. I know that's a crude expression, but in view of the nature of the building, he's having a mind, I think. One. And I wasn't, but I tell you what I'll do. I'll open the grapevine. You have only £3,000, and I'll do it for the £3,000. And they said, well, what is the breakdown and the figures? Well, he said, it'd be £1,000 for labour, it'd be £1,000 materials, and it'd be £1,000 profit. I think that's a fair offer. You know, you wouldn't get much better. They said, all right, we'll let you know. So the second man was a cavern builder. And they said, and what's your bid? He said, oh, £6,000. And they said, and what's the breakdown in that? Well, he said, there'd be £2,000 profit for a start, and I think it's 2,000, is it label or material, something like that. Anyway, it's £6,000 round figure, and if I wish you would grab it, you know, like, because it's a very good offer. That'll be gone up tomorrow, you know, everything's going up, but if I wish you would grab it, all right, we'll let you know. So the third man in was a builder from here, in Cork. And they said, and what's your bid? Whoa! 9,000 pounds. And they said, and what's the breakdown in that? 3,000 for you. $3,000 for me, and we give the job to the Dublin fella.
Oh, the wonderful Neil Tobin, and we'll have another classic comedy clip for you on tomorrow's programme. Coming up next, we speak to a journalist who's explored inside the secret world of the cocaine cartels of Colombia and followed a kilo of cocaine from its origins in the jungles of Colombia all the way to its consumers in the West. That's next.